Welcome to Frustrated and Exhausted, the podcast for women in leadership, where I help you fulfill your ambitions without sacrificing your sanity or your resilience. Hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Frustrated and Exhausted. I'm really glad you can be here with me today for this conversation with Claire Urquhart. Claire is a former corporate lawyer. She's travelled the world, done the high pressure thing, but she's also for the last 11 years been the co-founder and director of a wonderful charity called Open Books. She is also a trustee of the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and the work that she is doing now, I think, is genuinely inspirational. And I know you're going to really enjoy her take on leadership and building an organisation from the ground up. Claire, welcome to Frustrated and Exhausted. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Ruth.
Absolute pleasure. So we'll kick off, as we usually do, just by asking you to kind of give us a little bit of background about you, kind of where you're from and what you're all about.
So I grew up in a small town in the northeast of Scotland, and if you're a golfer, you'll know it, and if you're not, you probably won't. And went to school there and did a series of hires, as one does, and managed to come away with some good results. And in those days, I think there was a real push to do something at university that led to a career. So I had a very clear pathway. So, you know, law or medicine or accountancy or dentistry. And given that I had a pretty severe fear of blood, dentistry, medicine and vet were out, and I ended up studying law in Edinburgh. Can't say it was a major passion. It was definitely interesting. I met an amazing group of people, but followed the pathway, did my diploma and ended up doing my traineeship with a large corporate firm in Edinburgh. With offices in Glasgow and London, spent a little bit of time there and qualified into their litigation department. Ended up specialising in intellectual property. So I was doing a lot of drug industry pharmaceutical work. I was doing a lot of trademark work. It was a really exciting time. My boss was a woman and one of the few accredited specialists in intellectual property in Scotland. And as a result, she got really interesting work, and her team were predominantly women. So although I was in a corporate law firm where it was a very male-dominated environment, and, you know, there were still certainly traces of that in the work I was doing. On a day-to-day basis, I was working with a bunch of women at the cutting edge of their field, doing what very few others were in Scotland. So I did that for about 12 years. And it was really intellectually stimulating. There was a lot of thinking and reading and learning about things that I knew nothing about. And I really enjoyed it. There was a bit of travel involved as well. And then family came along. And I decided I would go back part-time. And it was quite surprising that that was facilitated. And I put that down to being in a very female environment. And it was okay. It was okay, to be honest. Everybody did their best to make it work. But the reality was I wanted to leave the office at 6 o'clock to go and pick up from nursery. And quite often in litigation, the really exciting stuff when you're rushing to court to get a judge and get a interim interdict or an order to stop something happening, that happens sort of after 6 p.m.
Yeah.
So I did that for a few years and I gradually got more and more frustrated with it and felt really I wasn't doing the mum thing properly and I wasn't doing the law thing properly. And then my own mum, who had been ill for quite a long time, died when I was pregnant with my second. And at that point, it really made me refocus on what I wanted to do. And I decided to take a bit of time out. And I was lucky enough to be able to do that and just spent some time at home as a stay-at-home mum, which looking back on, I can see very much that that became my career.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of tackled having the children and being at home very much the way I would have tackled a new court case. So, you know, I was squashing blueberries to make dye to colour the food icing for cakes and, you know, boiling up spinach when I needed green icing and, you know, very much, you know, making it a career, as it were. And I really enjoyed that time at home. But there did come a point about 5 years in when I was starting to think, okay, I need to think about what I can do.
Yeah.
That's a little bit different. And that finds a little bit more of me. I kind of felt what had happened is I'd very much been subsumed into the children's mum.
Yeah.
You know, the you know, people that I met at nursery or at school would have me on their phone as ex's mum.
Yeah.
Which was
okay.
You know, it was okay, but I kind of felt there was a whole other part of me that nobody knew about and that I was losing sight of a little bit myself. So I started to think about what I wanted to do and how I could, you know, find that bit of myself, do something that was rewarding and interesting, but at the same time, still make Sports Day and, you know, the recorder concert and, you know, assemblies in the middle of the day. And corporate law just wouldn't have facilitated that. And particularly at that time, which was, you know, round about the time of the financial crash, when really the opportunities to go back in as a sort of 12-year qualified specialist looking for a part-time role were very limited.
It's really interesting kind of what you said there about, and I recognise a lot actually of what you said around that transition out of really kind of focused career, focused work, and taking that same energy into kind of motherhood, basically, and kind of treating it in a similar way. And looking back, I probably wasn't that different, actually, probably quite similar. What is it that gives you that drive to, it's almost like that drive to do the best you possibly can?
I think part of it comes from being the firstborn daughter. I had a conversation once with a senior partner in the law firm I was working in who said his ideal candidate was a firstborn woman.
Wow.
Because without exception, they were people pleasers. They cared what other people thought. They were absolutely determined they were going to do their best. And they were entirely reliable.
Ouch.
I think that's quite an interesting and a little bit close to the bone.
Yeah, I know. I felt that, to be honest, as a firstborn daughter as well.
So I think partly that, and I do think losing my mum. My mum died when she was 62. And I think that really gave me a sense of not taking for granted your three score year and ten.
Yeah.
I wish it was 4 score year and 10. But you know, and really feeling a responsibility to live a good life and live a full life. You know, and that sort of making the most of opportunities. And I think, you know, there's a shadow of that playing into, you know, the determination to drive on and make the most and say yes and do things well and fill every moment, you know, I think comes from that. And the combination of the two is lethal.
Lethal and extremely effective, I imagine. What, you know, you've founded with Marjorie Open Books. What was it that led up to that? You sort of described that few years of kind of being at home, going for it as stay at home mum, you know, giving that your all, and then finding this point where it's like, okay, where am I in all of this? So how did that lead to Open Books?
So Margie and I were great friends long before the existence of Open Book, and we had 7 children between us. Margie was also a corporate lawyer. She worked in New York and then London. So we shared a lot of sort of similar interests and similar thoughts, and we were both real keen book lovers. Margie is now a sort of very well recognised author, poet, and her going through the American system, she had studied writing and as part of her first degree before she then went and did law. And my mum was an English teacher, and I'd always had a great love of books, but as I explained, the 80s system of education in Scotland was very much focused on a job. So we were great attendees at the Edinburgh Book Festival, you know, both for ourselves but also to take the children. And one of my the partner I worked for, in fact, the partner who gave me my job, was a trustee on the board there. And we'd bumped into him at Edinburgh just about the time our youngest were off to nursery, and we were starting to think, right, what are we going to do with ourselves now that Joe Jingles and Jiminy is not as frequent in our calendars as it once was. And he said to us, what would you do to make this place better? What would you do to improve? And we looked around and we kind of thought, you know, there's a lot of people that look like us with young children, and there's a lot of elderly people, but there's a lot of faces we're not seeing. And wouldn't it be great to make it a place, because we love it so much, that feels accessible to everyone? And just about the same time, one of Margie's friends, who was a GP, had come to us and said, over lunch, I think it was, you know, I wish I could prescribe a reading group. I have so many people that make appointments to come and see me as a GP, but actually, they just need a place to be and a conversation to have. And there's an organisation down in England called The Reader, and they're doing these amazing community shared reading groups. And if I could just prescribe one. And we kind of sort of thought, maybe there's something in this. Maybe what we can do is think about bringing reader groups to the book festival. So organising the logistics, maybe doing a bit of fundraising, maybe bringing our love of books into that, and sort of ticking those two goals. And we called the reader up and they said, that would be brilliant. We'd love that. Except we don't really operate in Scotland. And we thought about it a little bit longer, and then we thought, well, what we don't want to be doing is going into places and taking people on a lovely day out, and that's it. We want some sort of year-round connection with books. And that's where Open Book came along, because what we decided to do was to go into community groups and go into places where people were interested in reading together, and setting up groups that we would then facilitate taking to the book festival. So there would be this year-round engagement with reading and meeting together, and it's more a community sort of project really than a literacy project, but using books as a way to connect people. And we started off with two groups in Edinburgh, one in Little Sisters of the Poor, which was a care home just around the corner from us both, and one in the Grassmarket Community Project. And the Grassmarket group still meets every week. And the other one, the care home, closed down. But we've now expanded, and we run around 1,200 sessions a year in around 80, with 80 different groups. And that's from Shetland and Orkney all the way down through Ullapool and Brora and out on Skye, and down through the Central Belt to Dundee, Aberdeen, Perth, down as far south as Stranraer. So there's really been a need and a want for what we're doing. And this coming together and sharing of stories has really touched a lot of people. And, you know, we're almost overwhelmed with the number of requests for new groups, just about keeping on top of that.
So clearly there's been real success, and you've kind of identified a need that you're being able now to meet in our kind of society. That's kind of brought you obviously to a point where you started off, you know, small with a couple of groups, and now you're kind of in this position with 80 groups. That obviously requires a kind of a bit of an organisation sort of to develop around it, and the chance to kind of create your own way of doing things, of leading things, and your own kind of culture within your organisation. How did you and Marjorie go about thinking about that and creating that?
Well, I think originally it was quite an organic process. You know, in the very beginning, Margie and I were doing all the reading for all the groups, and we were doing all the paperwork, and we were ordering the books and popping them in the library and making sure that the books that went in came back out, and you know, all that sort of thing. But quite quickly, it became clear that it wasn't sustainable for us to continue to do all the reading and to do all the delivery. And I would say that was and remains a challenge for us because ultimately we set up Open Book to share stories and to do that reading. But the bigger we get and the more people who come on board with us, the more difficult it is for us to continue to do that delivery and the more time we are spending on the sort of management side. So making sure that all the, you know, that we have policies that guide the organization and guide us around things like environment and equality, because Open Book really is founded on the core of equality, diversity, inclusion, and access. So, you know, the wider our the populations that we reach grows, the more work we have to do in trying to get that inclusion aspect right. You know, the more, you know, just this week we've been experimenting with a transcription service. Because we ask each of our lead readers to, we call lead readers, that is the name we give to facilitators who work with our groups, but we ask each of them to prepare a feedback sheet after each session. So that's partly for us just to keep an eye that everything's going along. It's an opportunity for lead readers to let us know if something's not been quite right, and that can be, you know, the heating wasn't on, or someone came along who I'm worried about, or, you know, that's it's a range of things. It also allows them to keep track of what they've read, because I can tell you when you get to the end of a year of reading stories and poems, and you think, have I read this with the group, or just I read this myself? And also, it's increasingly becoming important for funding for us to be able to show numbers and, you know, locations and things. The feedback is a vital part of the organization, but for some of our lead readers, it's quite a difficult thing for them to do, you know. And it is, for example, we have groups that are support specific populations. So we have a group that's specifically people for people who are living with a chronic illness, and we have a group specifically for people who describe themselves as neurodiverse because their needs are slightly different from others. And that's not to say the reading of the material and the stories are around chronic illness or neurodiversity, but it just means that we can hold a space for people and meet their needs in a different way to the space we would hold for people who have sight loss. But it's important to us that the facilitators of those groups have the lived experience of the populations that they're reading with. So you can imagine that if you are living with a chronic illness and you have run a 2-hour session or an hour and a half session, and then at the end of that to have to write out or type up a feedback, it's, you know, it's potentially problematic. So, you know, we're looking at ways that we can support our lead readers, and we're looking at ways to make things more accessible, not just for the people attending our groups, but, you know, throughout the organization. So a lot of our time is spent on that sort of work now, support working out the best ways to support our lead readers. Also funding, you know, in the cultural landscape at the moment, funding is particularly difficult. So, you know, thinking about that, thinking about strategy, trying to make ourselves a robust and resilient organization that is going to last. So increasingly, that's the work that we're doing. And as I say, it started off as quite an organic process. We kind of looked at what we needed as we needed it. But we now both are much more focused in trying to look ahead and prepare. And we have, you know, strategic aims and business plans. And both of us have sat on various other boards and organizations and learned a lot from that process in terms of how other organizations are run and you know, sought to bring the good bits and improve the not so good bits.
How would you sort of characterize your leadership style? in the way that you and Marjorie lead the organization?
I think that we would both like to say, and we have this sort of odd relationship, not odd, but lovely relationship where we're both very much, very often on the same page. So there's not often a difference between us and how we want to do things. And that, that brings its own challenges because we do question, are we missing perspectives? Are we not seeing things because we are so similar in the way we think? So I would say we would characterize ourselves both as empathetic. You don't found an organization with a core aim of diversity, equality, inclusion without having a desire to be empathetic and reach out to other people. And I would say we try very hard to be a democratic in our approach, in that to seek input from other colleagues in the office, but also wider than that, our community of lead readers, our community of participants. And we spend quite a lot of time, doing an annual evaluation, asking people what they think, asking them for their suggestions, and reading and implementing those. It's not a tick box exercise for us. We commit a lot of time and energy to in gathering that information, but then implementing when and where we can. But evaluation brings its own challenges. We really want to be a place where everyone can access our groups and everyone feels welcome. But if you turn up at a group and your pen is put in your hand and a piece of paper is put in front of you and you're asked to tick boxes about what you think and what you do and how you feel, that of itself can be a barrier to access. So when we're doing our evaluation, we are thinking about, offering it by phone so people can phone us up and tell us what they think, offering pieces of paper in the group that people can tick boxes, offering it online if you prefer to go away and do it, not in the context of the group. Just thinking about how we can make that process as democratic and as accessible. So I would say that is our aim. But inevitably, in an organization as it grows, there comes a point where sometimes as in a leadership role, you just have to make those decisions yourself. You have to recognize that your approach is not going to please everyone. And, Open Book is a charity, so we act as trustees as well as directors, and we're very aware, probably the lawyers in us, you can take the girl out of law and all that, that our responsibility is to act in the best interests of the charity. And so that is really the governing principle against which we are decision making.
It's really interesting listening to you talk about the extent, and obviously that's linked to the purpose of the organization, but the extent to which you go to reduce those barriers for people in order to enable them to engage. What do you think other public sector or corporate organizations could learn from your approach? Because you go to some lengths, and we often hear stories about people not being able to get back to work. Or, after illness or whatever it might be, they're in their circumstances, not being able to gain the access that they need in order to join and be part of society effectively or be part of a workplace because of barriers that are put up. And, I understand that legally, obviously, in theory, organizations are required to make reasonable adjustment. What can they learn from your approach to actually embrace that rather than seeing it as a hurdle or something that has to be done?
I would say that we work really hard and we don't always get it right. There are times when we've looked back and thought we could have done that better, or this would have been a better way to do it, or and just learning, simple things. Like, for example, I didn't realize that certain documents, like some PDFs, can't be read by a screen reader. So when we were supporting a group for people with sight loss, and we had, checked out that everyone had screen readers, and then it was an online group, so we were sharing the materials, the stories and the poems that we were reading together online. And, very early on, we had shared a PDF that was entirely inappropriate. And that was just, you know, us missing, us dropping the ball on that and missing it. But it's about learning. So I think you have to be open to learning and open to listen. I think it's really important to engage with the people you are trying to support, and ask them what would help them. But again, you know, without putting the responsibility on them to tell you what they need.
Yeah.
You know, but to have these open conversations is to recognize you won't always get it right, but to be willing to change. I think it's really important to allocate budget for that. I mean, you have to set aside money to walk the walk as well as talk the talk. And that is the reality that we live in. So I think that's really important. And I think I would say that I know of organisations who are really well intentioned, but haven't set aside that access budget. I think organisations are getting better at that. I think it's really important to meet people where you find them. So what someone needs on one day isn't necessarily what they'll need on another day. And something that's worked in 1 week might not work the next week. And I think being open to that and constantly willing to adapt and doing that from top down. So I think that has to come from the leadership team, that willingness to change, even though it might cost a bit more money, even though it might take a bit more time, even though it might involve doing something a bit differently from the way we've always done it. I think if the team feels that is truly the ethos of the company, it really, or the organization, it really helps make those changes. And I think it helps your the people who are using your services feel safe and held and able to ask for what they need. And I think, you know, there's a lot of paperwork in that. And, you know, we were sitting in the office yesterday having our weekly team meeting. And one of our lead readers had flagged a possibility of an issue around wheelchair access. And we thought we had covered that. We had to go back to our access questionnaire because we don't start new groups in places where the access is not good. Some of our older groups, we have to be slightly more flexible on that because historically they've met in a particular place. But we certainly now would not start a new group where the access was not very good. And so we had gone back and right enough, that question had been slightly fudged by the organisation. And so when we had looked at it, it had, on the face of it, would have worked. But actually drilling down a little bit deeper. So that then is a case of going back to that organisation and sort of saying, well, can we now meet downstairs? And do you have rooms? And what can we do? And you know, so it there's a lot of paperwork. It takes a lot of time, but you have to prioritize it. You have to really make everyone within the organization believe that it is key to your aims and objectives.
What has been, you know, in establishing your own organization, what's been the biggest challenge for you as a leader?
I think it is the work-life balance. I think when you have established that organisation yourself, it is your baby. And particularly in the days when we were both working from our kitchen tables, it was very hard for that not to be 24/7. We now have a small office, and I think that helps delineate a lot better. And I think it takes a degree of discipline, personal discipline, because I think what's important to remember is that if you are working outside working hours and sending emails and looking at things and texting, and inevitably you are pulling somebody else into that conversation and you're eating into their time. You know, even if you say, and you know, we've been known, Margie and I've been known to text each other on a Sunday afternoon and say, you know, I fell so far behind last week, I'm just going to spend a couple of hours catching up. Ignore me. But inevitably you don't. you jump onto, oh, what's she been doing and what's she thinking of, and or I'll stop myself if something occurs to me, maybe on a Saturday morning when I'm standing at the side of a hockey pitch. In the early years, I would have texted Margie and said, oh, it's just occurred to me we didn't do X, Y, and Z. And now I will put it on our Monday team meet to-do list with notifications turned off that I'm doing that. I say that, but I think part of the success of the organization has been that drive and that commitment and that desire to do it well and work hard for it. And both coming from a corporate law background, there is a legacy of working really hard and really long hours that we kind of have to fight against and pull each other up on. We will send each other texts now saying, why are you online? My Slack notifications are pinging.
I love that you've kind of got a work-life balance accountability partner.
Well, exactly. But it does drift. One of us is better one week than the other, and it varies. So I would say for me, that's the hardest thing. But it's a joy. I mean, doing something that you love, building something that people, the feedback that we get and the evaluation that we get. We recently did our spring evaluation, and 97% of the people that responded, and there was, I think, around 250, 260 people that took the time to respond to us, which is quite a lot, given how many surveys you, if you're anything like me, and the number of emails, surveys you get in. 97% said they felt better about themselves after spending time in an open book group.
That's amazing.
So although there are days when we come in and think, oh my goodness, we've got a massive fundraising application to write and we need to report on XYZ and the accounts are due and we've got the draft from the accountants and they've been sitting in our inboxes for 2 weeks and the board papers need pulled together for the next board meeting. And neither of us are going to pick up a book or read a poem all day today, which was kind of the reason, you kind of have to remember that the fact that we are doing something we love and we are doing something that we're proud of,
And rightly so. Think of all those lives that have been impacted positively as a result of what you're doing. I get a real sense of the drive and the commitment and the purpose that lies, that impact that you're aiming for in terms of benefiting others and giving to others, really, in terms of that connection and so that nourishment that people get from being in those groups when they meet together. But it's interesting as well what you say there about there's this drive and purpose and joy that comes from that. But there's also a need to be vigilant that that doesn't tip into kind of a depleting, exhausting sort of sense and trying to maintain that balance. Because when you have that drive, it's hard to switch off. I have always found the same challenge, no matter kind of what role I've been doing. But I would say actually, in some ways, since I started my own business, it's been harder, as you say, because it's yours, it's your thing, and you kind of want to nurture it and kind of grow it and do what you love to do. So I really recognize what you're saying about fighting that legacy of long hours and kind of the that hard focused kind of work. Has it ever been lonely?
Well, I think because Margie and I have such a great relationship as friends, and the friendship came first. I would say corporate law, in a way, was more lonely at times. That sort of responsibility for decision making, particularly in a litigation setting where you could only ever be right or wrong. You only ever won your case or you lost your case. No one in a litigation setting would ever say to you, well, bad luck, but I know how hard you worked preparing for that. And didn't you do a really good job of keeping your notes neat? So it was very black and white. Whereas I think that so much of what we're doing now with Open Book is about sharing. and is about building connections, and it's about using literature as a way to create communities that might not otherwise have existed. That I wouldn't say loneliness was something particularly that I was aware of, but I think probably a large part of that is due to the fact that Margie and I are in this together, and we do it together, and we are so much on the same page in terms of how we think strategically the organization should go. And I mean, that's not to say we agree on absolutely everything, or the, you know, the route, but the end goal that we have is very much aligned. And, you know, we're really good at accommodating each other, particularly if there's something that one or other of us feels very strongly about.
That sense of a shared end goal kind of really brings me on to something that I kind of wanted to ask last time we spoke as well, actually. What is the lasting legacy that you want to create with Open Book?
For us, and you know, we're both in our 50s, and you know, we are thinking about succession planning, and we're thinking not immediately, but we are thinking about sort of long-term exit strategies. And I think for us, it's a robust, resilient organization that isn't entirely dependent on the two of us, and that is so well set up and so well organized that it is possible for us to step away and for Open Book to continue successfully without us. And I think, you know, as we bring through our team that work with us, we're seeing more and more of our ability to do that. You know, our processes are much better than they were when we started. Our ability to express the Open Book model and the way we work and how we operate is much better. You know, we spend quite a lot of time training people that come to work with us and to deliver for us as consultants. And, you know, we have those resources, and we've run conferences, and we've recorded those sessions, and they are available. And so I think for me, success looks like being able to step off to the side quietly and to have Open Book continue successfully. I'm not ready to do that quite yet, I hasten to add. But I think for both of us, would be really upsetting is if there came a point when we felt we wanted to do something else. Cause we've both got loads of other things we're interested in doing and want to do at some point, and Open Book stopped or finished or, you know, no longer survived. So, you know, building that legacy and that succession and the planning around that and what that looks like, I think for us is going to be quite a big part of our work over the next sort of 5 to 10 years.
Claire, thank you so much for sharing all of that. I find what you do really, really inspirational. I take my hat off to you and to Marjorie for building this, because to be able to impact so many people in such challenging circumstances, some of them, many of them, and bring people together and just create that connection, which I'm sure for many people is probably the high point of their week, their month, you know, and to do that through books and the nourishment that can bring through being with people, and through the literature itself, I think is absolutely inspiring. So thank you very, very much for speaking.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And you probably have gathered that I could talk about Open Book all day, and I've had great joy in doing so. So it has truly been a pleasure.
Diversity, equity, inclusion and accessibility have really been getting a pummeling in the press recently and in politics. And I think what we've just heard from Claire is, you know, we're talking about leading with empathy, we're talking about empathetic leadership. And if we're talking about that and we're actually going to do that, what we are actually talking about is DEIA. And there were some really key messages that she put forward there around that I think are worth reiterating and kind of amplifying. as much as possible. If you're going to commit to being an organisation or a leader who really means what they say around diversity, equity and inclusion, you have to be open to really listening to people and being prepared to have got it wrong, but listening to what people actually need and really engaging with them to understand that. You also need to, you know, be prepared to allocate the budget and the money in order to enable that accessibility sometimes, to pay for the additional support that might be required, you know, whatever that might look like for an individual. And I loved what Claire said about meeting people where you find them, because those needs can change even for one individual from one week to the next, from one day to the next. And I think that's a really key point for any kind of management or leadership. People don't stay the same. And just because someone shows up sort of in one way one day, they're not going to be the same the next. None of us are. So it's really being kind of eyes and ears open and sort of being prepared to really listen. And I think what she said about actually that willingness to adapt in order to enable inclusion, in order to enable accessibility, really has to come from the top. That tone has to be set at the top in leadership terms, or people are not going to see it as important. They're not going to see it as something valuable. They're not going to see it as something that, you know, there's a real commitment to. So there is something here about really walking the walk, not just talking the talk around diversity, equity and inclusion. And, you know, Claire and Marjorie's organisation, Open Book, I'll put details of their website and things in the show notes so that you can get in touch if you want to. But they're really living and breathing it. It's the absolute foundation of what they do, is trying to bring people together and people who might struggle actually normally to be part of a group or be in a group or be included in society. And they're really trying hard to reach those people and to create these connections through a love of reading and a love of literature. I really think that it's an important point, and that this should kind of be baked into anybody's idea of, you know, if you think you have empathy, then living that empathy means making the budget allocations. It means really listening, and it means being prepared to adapt. Thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to being with you next week, where I'll be talking a little bit more about loneliness at work. So join me for that. Thanks for listening to this episode of Frustrated and Exhausted. Hit the follow button for future episodes. You can also follow me on Instagram at Resonate Leadership and LinkedIn at Ruth Alexandra Wood. I'd absolutely love to hear from you. Frustrated and Exhausted is brought to you by Resonate Leadership and the wonderful team at the Podcast Boutique. I'm your host, Ruth Wood. Take care and speak to you soon.